We are live, folks, with episode 3786 of the Survival Podcast. Today, Tuesday, it's January the 13th, 2026, and we're starting just a couple minutes late because the girl dogs wanted back in the house and I am alone. So hopefully they will not harass us while we're live. If you're on audio only, you get that part edited out. But occasionally when the wife is not here and the dogs cause a problem and I don't want to clean up poop when I'm done, you guys have to wait for me for a few moments while I go let them out. I don't think that's going to happen today because they were just out for a good 15 minutes and I wanted them in so they weren't outside the window barking to come in, because they will do that shit. Anyway, what are we going to talk about today? Well, yesterday we went into all kinds of political shit and violence and the shootings and all of that. And I had special libertarians write me all kinds of hate emails. Guys, I don't care. I don't care. You don't get to tell me I'm a libertarian or not. You don't get to be the arbiter of that, and you also are not grounded in reality, so that's fine. Today we're going to talk about something way different, though, but still in the spirit of rebellion, but intelligent rebellion rather than what I call retarded rebellion. Yep. We're going to talk about rebel canning. Exactly what it sounds like. Rebellious canning. Canning, like when we take stuff and we put it in a jar, it's not really a can, and we put a lid on it, and we stick it inside a vessel and we heat it up and then it seals and then we put it on the shelf and 6 months later we eat it and we don't die. Canning, like that, yeah. What is rebel canning? I'll tell you all about it today, but it's basically telling the USDA, yeah, we hear you, that's fine, go away. Doesn't mean we ignore everything they say. It just we ignore some of the things we say, and we do it with an understanding of what's real and what is not real. Okay? That's what it means. That's what it means. We do it with an understanding of what is real and what is not real. Anyway, as we're doing this today, I want to kind of just make sure that I'm being clear in everything I'm going to talk about today. And I want to come out of the gate even before we get into it and just say, I am not saying to do things specifically because the government says not to, in this space or any space. I'm saying that there's places where, like, this is, first of all, these things are not laws. They're not even codes. They're guidance. And government guidance has a lot of weaknesses, but it also requires you to be an informed person when you go outside those boundaries. And I'm going to give you good reasons for why people are doing this today. And we're going to talk a little bit about the criticism from people that, well, they shouldn't be criticizing a thing that they don't know anything about. And when you read their articles about it and stuff, and when you see their concerns, and when they pop up a Karening on a Facebook group or something, you're like, you don't know anything. But if you're going to say, I'm not going to follow guidance from an authority, then you're taking on all the responsibility. So I want to be clear about that. Before we get into it, though, can we go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day today? Starting out, JM Bullion. You know, I've been recommending silver and gold as part of your investment portfolio since I started doing the show back in 2008. And in 2008, I gave a recommendation, 5% of your net wealth in precious metals. That was my baseline recommendation. And I would say 5 to 10, but I would always say the 10% is as high as I'm comfortable with. And 5 is about as low. So it's somewhere in that range. But personally, for me, it's about 5%. And in 2026, I am still recommending 5 to 10% of your net wealth in silver and gold. But almost like being consistent is important, especially if you have been proven right by history. Don't change your future recommendations. And one thing you're not going to hear me change anytime soon is who to get your silver and gold from. Now, I know, well, they're a sponsor, Jack. Of course you said that. Yeah, but I've turned down Lear Capital, Apmex, Monex, and whatever the one is that what's his name is always on gold on TV shilling to you, William Devane, right? I've turned like 4 other companies down, and this is why. JM Bullion is a sponsor. They've been a sponsor for 12 years, and they have stayed with us for 12 years. They give a discount to my listeners, which no one else wants to do. I can talk directly to the president. Your order is going to ship free, and you're going to pay less per ounce with JM over all the other people I just mentioned. So why the hell would I recommend anybody else? And the answer is I wouldn't. Check out JM Bullion today and keep stacking that silver and gold. It has proven to be a good decision for those who have done so from the past. All right. Next up today, Fortress Canine. If you want to learn how to train yourself to train your dog, this is the website that you need to go to, canineacademy.us. Get on that site and get down lower on it, and you will see all these different options to enroll. Options from as little as $20 a month, a one-time course is $62. But then you see one right over toward the right-hand side that says free with the little cute kid in the cap, the problem-solving library. Why don't you today, if you're a dog owner and you want to do a better job of training and maintaining your dog and your relationship with your dogs, go to canineacademy.us and sign up for the problem-solving library. It costs nothing. See what it's like to learn from Joel, and then you can decide if one of these other options works well for you. Again, the site is canineacademy.us. It is basically a division of Fortress Canine, because Joel Riles also trains some of the best protection dogs in the business. He breeds his own dogs out of three separate breeds, Dutch Shepherds, German Shepherds, and Belgian Malinois. I actually have a Malinois Shepherd cross from Joel because some dog who wasn't supposed to get bred broke out of her kennel and got bred when she was supposed to be in a resting cycle. And that happened to be the one that I ended up with was our dog Bellamy. She's a wonderful dog. I have never had a dog quite like Bellamy. It's definitely worth checking out Fortress Canine and Canine Academy to learn more about Joel's work. And he's just a good dude overall, guys. Really. Joel's the kind of guy that he really cares about people. He serves as a member of the expert council for us, for the community, and a whole lot more. So anyway, let's go ahead and dig on into this Rebel canning thing. I have to say Rebel canning is both new and old to me. And what I mean is the spirit of you can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. I can make decisions for myself when it comes to canning something. Is something I've done for as long as I've canned. I grew up with a Ukrainian grandmother who knew her way around both a water bath and a pressure canner. I was learning how to can from my grandma when I was an eight-year-old little boy. So we didn't even know what the USDA canning guidelines were. She had lots of recipes and procedures that mostly her and other, you know, Ukrainian grandmas and chuchis and aunts, right, had shared over the years. But I guarantee you they didn't give a damn what the United States government said. And somehow nobody in my family died of anything or got even sick from food. And I'm going to share some numbers on how unlikely it is for canning by any form, unless you're a complete idiot, is to give you a foodborne illness today. Okay. I'll just do it with this, right? So this is based on raw numbers and math. If you can food every day, including Rebel canning methods, but you actually do the things that people in these groups that I'm going to tell you about do, and we look at the numbers across the board in the United States for foodborne illnesses that trace back to home-based canning. If you can a lot and you eat one canned food meal a day, every day, 24/7, 365, you eat one a day minimum, and you get in a car and drive away from your home and home only twice a week, you are still 40,000 times more likely to die in a car wreck than you are from canned food. That should put it in perspective. And I have to say that for anyone that does not put it in perspective for, I think you don't want it to be in perspective. I think you want to object to this. It's just not the dangerous thing that we've been told about it. But Rebel canning is something, again, I think the name is new, but the spirit is old. And it's a lot of these groups that are, you know, homesteader types, homestead mamas and things like that, that are like, wait a minute, my grandma taught me this. I know I can't do this because today, like all of a sudden it changed. There's a lot of things as well that the government used to have nothing to say about, and now they say you can't do it that way, even though all their results are mostly like 50 years old. And we ended up with some really dumb USDA guidelines. And I think to understand how we ended up here and understand why some people are like, no, I'm not going to do what you say, and understand that it is not just a pure like a childish, well, I'm going to do what you say not to do, right? Like, it's not that. There's reasoning for it, and it's because most of the guidelines are actually around 40 to 50 years old or older. That's the first problem. See, if you go back to World War II and back, the United States government, you know, wasn't perfect. It had a lot of flaws. But one thing it did have going for it is it really wanted you and me, or and more accurately, your grandparents and your great-grandparents, to be self-sufficient. Because they knew that was a national security issue and a stability issue. It's what got us through things like the Great Depression and what have you. So they were actually very pro food storage, food canning, you know, gardening during World War II, victory gardens, all of that. About the time World War II wrapped up, the United States kind of shifted into much more of a consumer-driven world. Hey, come home and get your cover craft. I mean, literally that kind of mentality going on. You know, everybody will be flying around in flying cars by 1990, and we'll have jetpacks and shit, right? And I and Tim, we're still waiting for our fucking jetpacks, and we don't have them. And so any real effort into this kind of just – this became like a back of the room issue. Like, we don't really – we got to put – we got to say something. But we don't really care. We certainly don't want to like hide. Like, there's no reason to put a bunch of taxpayer money, because when they don't want to do something, all of a sudden it's taxpayer money. But when they want to do something, all of a sudden it's the government's money. You ever notice that? So there's no reason to put a lot of taxpayer money into this. Not that many people do it anyway. It's not a strategic thing for us. Blah, 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 blah. So you just kind of left with these guidances. And the guidances themselves are not bad in and of themselves. But we have to remember that government is really good at saying not to do things, and they are unwilling to take much of a leap in saying that something is safe if they haven't tested it. So here's one example of how stupid these things are. When the guidance was originally done for canning tomatoes, it was done with crushed tomatoes. So this is how we get into this stupidity. So what the USDA says is, don't make any canning recipe unless you're following a published recipe according to guidance. So then people turn around and they dice their tomatoes and they can them according to the guidance for a crushed tomato, which, by the way, is perfectly fine. But, oh, the whole surface ratio is, we don't really know. Shut up. That's what I'm talking about, where it's okay to have it crushed or sliced, but not diced. And the reason isn't that the United States government tested diced tomatoes and said, hey, if you dice them, you get sick. It's not like they ran a bunch of batches and said A batch was crushed and they were all good, and B batch was diced and 4 out of 5 had a toxin in them, which is what's implied. Right. When you say you have to follow the guidance, then you're implying that you've tested it and only the way you say to do it passed. But what the reality is, the amount of testing done was limited. It was actually very well done by universities and laboratories. And if they say something's safe, it is. That doesn't mean if they don't make a comment on something else, or they say, since we haven't tested that, don't do it, that it's dangerous. And that's where these rebel canning groups are coming from. There's things I want to make that you don't have any guidance for other than not to do it. And that doesn't make any sense. So I'm going to understand pressure canning, water bath canning, acid, fat, times, durations, etc. And I'm going to extrapolate. If I make a certain soup and there's no approved procedure for that soup, I'm going to say, hey, if this is the guidance for chicken soup, then my soup that I made that has chicken in it, but it's kind of something else, is probably going to be about the same as that guidance. And if I'm not really sure, and it says 30 minutes at 15 PSI, then I'll run it for 35 minutes just to be sure. And the number one thing that people come up with as to why this is so dangerous is, of course, botulism. Well, that, you know, foodborne illness versus dying in a car wreck included botulism and all the other serious foodborne illnesses you could possibly get from canned food, based on how many cases of people actually getting sick from canned food there is. And by the way, with the botulism thing, let me tell you how stupid this is. Let's say you have the reason, first of all, botulism is considered such a big risk is, unlike just about everything else that can go wrong, you can't tell it happened. Botulism means a low acid, low oxygen, high moisture environment. So if we can something like meat or a vegetable that's not acidic and we don't add enough vinegar or something like that, okay? If we do that, then we create a perfect environment to cultivate botulism in. And the reason we use pressure canning versus water bath canning is water, of course, turns to steam above 212 degrees. Boiling point, that's the highest temperature liquid water at sea level, not under pressure, can reach. Once it goes above that, it turns into steam. Botulism spores require a higher temperature to kill. Okay? So when we put it under steam, we get into somewhere like 240-something, 260-something. I don't remember which one. But we get a higher temperature when we put it under pressure. We pressurize the steam. And we can hold higher temperatures in the vessel. That means we can bring the food in the jar up to that temperature if we give it sufficient time. And that temperature will kill the botulism spores. So now when the jar seals at the end of the process, it does not cultivate botulism. Okay, that's all good and well. And that's why, oh my God, if it's even iffy and you water bath can it, everybody's going to die. Okay, the other reason that we're so concerned about botulism is it's incredibly toxic. And before we have modern treatments, which we have now, by the way, you still don't want it, it was a very high fatality rate. So you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it, you can't tell it's there, and it can kill you dead. Okay, I understand the concern. But here's what they never tell you about botulism. You know where botulism is right now? On your hands, on your face, on your tongue, on the food you just ate for breakfast or lunch. It will be on the food you eat for dinner. It's on your countertop. It's on your walls. Botulism's literally everywhere as spores. And botulism itself as spores is not toxic to human beings at all. You eat it all the time. It's in your mouth as we speak. That's how common it is. It has to be under the right conditions to grow. When it grows and multiplies in those oxygen-free, moist, low-acid environments at, you know, like room temp, at a warm enough temperature, an incubation temperature sufficient for it to grow, okay? Then it produces a toxin as a result of its reproduction. It's still, the botulism's not the toxin. It's a toxin the botulism produces. Why is this important? If we had a can of, let's say, canned corn that was improperly canned, and it didn't have any kind of bacterial or something like that, it was just a botulism toxin that infected it, and we dump that can into a pot, and we turn the pot on to heat it up, and instead of just heating it up till it's warm, we heat it up till it's simmering, like boiling temperature. And we do, and maybe we even have to add a little liquid to it. I don't know, depending on how it was canned, right? And so that it's in a simmering liquid, like water or broth. And it simmers in that broth for 10 minutes, which you're not going to overcook it because it's already overcooked because it's canned. Then that botulism toxin is denatured and evaporated and gone and rendered inert and will not hurt you. Almost every other form of contamination to all canned goods will be evident. You'll have busted seals. You'll have some sort of evidence. You'll have bad smells and off smells. There are some things. The girl dogs are upset, but they're not bothering me, so they can bark at. The Amazon man probably came. So almost everything else is going to have some tell. And I think there is one thing that can be hard to detect, but if that were there, you'd probably have like yeast molds or something else causing other spoilage, right? So this is just not the huge risk that we're told that it is. So what are some examples of rebel canning? What are some of the things people are doing in these groups that are outside the USDA recommendations and causing Karens? Karens are coming from everywhere. There's articles on Medium. There's one that's like, it is the dumbest corner of the internet, right? There's everybody posts these videos of what they're doing. They descend. The Karens come in and tell them they're all going to die. Most of them, you can tell, they have never canned anything in their life. They don't know anything. They have no point having an opinion. So what are the evil things these people are doing as rebel canners? One, dry potato canning. Well, this is almost new to me. Some of them par cook the potatoes. Some of them, they use the potatoes raw. They dice up like, you know, regular Idaho potatoes. I'm not going to give you recipes, but just kind of the basics are they use a little bit of butter is in with those potatoes along with seasoning. And then they do the jars like normal and they can them. And you're not supposed to do that. But you know what happens? This is like one of the most popular things being done. There's thousands of people doing this. Nobody's getting sick. Nobody's dying. And let me add to that, right? The U.S. government goes out of their way to make a giant to-do when Betty fucks up canning her potatoes, makes 20 cans of canned potatoes fucked up. They do have botulism. She takes them down to the church picnic, dumps them all in a crock pot, sets it at 160 degrees, warms them up, follows no procedure, and a few people get sick from those potatoes. They announce, oh, my God, oh, my God. There's so few of these. I checked over the last 10 years. It's in the neighborhood of 1 to 3 events a year in a country with 330 million people and millions of homesteaders who can't. It's not even a rounding error. It doesn't make any sense to be this freaked out about it. And it's almost inevitable when you find out what really happened, the people that did it were idiots. And understand the government issues its guidance from a lowest common denominator standpoint. Yeah. All right. So dry potato canning, many things that are simply cut or sliced differently than the guidance says. You know, for instance, they tell, you know, for years and years and years, my grandma did this every year. We would have butternut squash and she would roast the butternut squash, mash it and put it, it was like a mash into a can and then pressure can that. And when we would pull it out, what it mainly was used for is making soups, which were always simmered with other things added to them at the time. Nobody ever got sick. Nobody ever died. Somewhere along the way, USDA said, oh, no, it's too dense. It's too dense. So dice the butternut squash, and it's not too dense. But dice the tomatoes, which are a high acid food in the first place, and they're bad. Like so it's just a matter of the form of the thing in the can. In fact, that's one of the biggest differences. Many soups and stews that just don't have a USDA recipe. So somebody's just making something called something different. And so what they do is they actually go to USDA and it says, you know, if you're doing like something like beef soup or something, you know, beef vegetable soup, do it for this long at this pressure. And they just use it as an analog. So they're actually following guidance, but the Karens would say and the government would say, oh, no, we don't have a procedure for that. You can't do it. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Many times it might even be just some people reuse lids. And I know what you're going to say because I've said it myself. They're so damn cheap. Did it work or did it not work? Do we really need to throw away these lids? Are they really one use? They either seal or they do not seal. If a seal fails, you know it's failed. Don't eat it. So that is like that's a big one in of itself that some people use them as well. Mostly it's just figuring out how to can something based on the closest thing to it in a published recipe. That's mostly what this is. Sometimes it's water canning something. The government says can't be water canned. And sometimes the government's wrong. And you need to be more informed. I'm going to tell you how to do that when you're making decisions like that. And again, have good procedures. Like I said, like when I eat anything that was canned, it always gets brought to a boil for a time before I eat it. I never dump something out of a can and eat it cold. And I don't advise that you do either, especially things that can incubate botulism, right? If it was some, now, if it's like canned dilly beans, because that's high acid, I'll eat that cold. But it, you know, a food that you would normally eat warm, and it's not high acid or isn't high acid, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to bring it to a simmer for 10 minutes. And I'm going to be just end that concern whatsoever. And sometimes it's oven canning. Some of these groups today do have people that talk about a form of oven canning, which I'm not going to get into today. I don't actually recommend that. And I can explain why really, really fast. I want you to, like, the next time it's like 32 degrees outside, open a door. Yeah. Stick your arm out there for 1 minute and leave your hand out in the air at 32 degrees for 1 minute and then bring your hand in. Your hand will be cold. but you won't be like, oh my God, it hurts. Then fill up a bowl with water. Use your other hand that's nice and warm. Fill up a bowl with water and ice cubes, about half water, half ice cubes. Stick your hand in there for a minute and see what happens. You're probably going to get to about 20 seconds. You're like, F that. Screw Jack. That hurts. And it might take a while before it stops hurting. Why? Because liquid transfers temperature into other things much quicker than air does. And when you're doing a oven canning, you're heating the air and you're trying to transfer from air into a solid. And it just takes a lot longer, and there's really probably not a really great reason for doing it. Okay? There are some things people put in jars that they do like an oven can type thing with, and I don't really mind it because that thing would be stable without it being in a jar. Okay? But it's just really probably not the best idea. Let me give you some top guidance if you want to go down this path and learn more about it. Number one, seek out groups and communities. And as much as I hate some things about Facebook, it's probably the best place for this. I gave you the title of this today, group intelligence versus groupthink. Group intelligence is when you have, sovereign individuals coming together, communing as a group, all combining their wisdom together and then coming to a consensus as a group. This has been done by these 10 people. They all have good results. What they say tracks with what we know and known science. So this is a generally safe practice for our community. That's group intelligence. Groupthink is NPCs. Follow USDA guidance. The USDA is the premier organization for food safety in the modern world. Do exactly what they say. And everybody chanting it together like a weird cult. And that is most of society for most things in America today. Groupthink. COVID showed you about 70 to 80% of people in this country are people who are group thinkers. And, 20 to 30% are people that believe in practicing group intelligence. It is the same dynamic, whether people want that to be true or not. Learn the why before the rules. Understand things like acidity, density, heat, and time. So guidance becomes a reference instead of a script. Okay. Again, I'll remind you, the government builds its standards to the lowest common denominator. This even includes doctors. Here's an example. Vitamin D. I don't remember if it's IUs or whatever the measurement, nanoliters per liter or something like that. But the number in a blood test, that if you're above that number, it's considered high for vitamin D is 100. And like your zone that you want to be in is like 30 to 100. Below 30 is low. Above 100 is high. But what is the number at which it actually becomes a threat to you physically? And that number is 300. That number is 300, not 100. So the limit is one third of the actual limit. Why did they do this? Well, it was the 1920s and 30s when they discovered vitamin D. They didn't even understand yet that it was actually a hormone. They thought of it. That's why they call it a vitamin. Vitamin D is not a vitamin. Actually, it's a hormone. And they figured out that if you push the number up to about 300, it could cause certain problems with calcification and things like that. But they weren't sure, and they didn't have time to do more research on it because we're moving up into the years of the Second World War. And so they just said, to be safe, we know that 100 is good enough, and we'll just divide it by 3, and we'll call it 100. This is what they do with everything. Because no matter what you tell people, some people that once it's canned, okay, now it's good, they'll just, open it and maybe dump half of it out and put the lid back on it, stick it on the shelf. You don't think so? Yeah, people are that stupid. So remember always the guidance is being given to the stupid, the conformist, the person with the 85 IQ. And they have to write guidance for the person with the 85 IQ because they're part of the general population. Unfortunately, much too large of a part of the general population. If you were writing these guidelines for people with, 110 IQs and up, then you could be more the form of guidance instead of recipes. But that's not what they're doing. So I don't even blame the government for this, right? I blame the people not smart enough to understand what I just said to you. Use the official data as an anchor. If a process works for a comparable food, use that as a guide. Add 10 minutes if you feel the need to. That's another way to approach this. Remember, botulism risk is about the toxin, not the spores. So when somebody tells you boiling botulism won't prevent botulism, they're right and wrong, depending on how you mean it. There will be exactly as much botulism on the green beans you pick and cook today as there will be on the green beans you take out of the can and cook today if there was ever botulism there and it was improperly canned. The toxin is the problem, and cooking for 10 minutes at least a temperature of boiling will eliminate the toxin. The end. This is science. This is not Jack Spirko's opinion, right? Most canning failures announce themselves: bulging lids, leaks, off smells, broken seals. Discard anything like that. If it looks wrong, get rid of it and follow the cook before you eat real, and you'll be fine. Once open, food is just food. So actually, you know how much, there's actually a lot of foodborne illnesses, cases of foodborne illness in the United States every year. Serious cases that require some level of treatment at a hospital, about 44 to 48,000 a year. But traced back to home canning, about 150 to 250 in any given year of any kind of foodborne illness, traced back in any way to home canning. But just because it was traced back to home canning doesn't mean the canning was the problem. Most foodborne illness comes from how food is handled. Comes from how food is handled, unless it comes from the store infected, which happens as well, right? And what I mean by that is that, like, the number one cause of actual botulism infection in the United States today is improperly handled potatoes, because they're dense and they can be low to oxygen, and, you know, potatoes stored at room temperature in foil after they've been cooked for too long, and then they're just warmed up and served. That's a classic way that it happens. It also happens in densely packed things that are held, you know, that are brought to warm temperatures, but not original cooking temperatures, that were improperly stored for a time, like rice. Like, this is where people actually get sick. It is from the way food is handled, the way it's stored, the way it's taken care of when it's cooked, et cetera. And so even when they say, well, these 250 this year were traced back to canned food, it doesn't mean that because the food was improperly canned. It is often the case that somebody opened up a big can, ate some of it and was particularly fine, and then later on the food became a problem because it wasn't put back in the refrigerator, or it was in some way improperly handled. Okay? Sorry, that's just the way it is. And it's also the case that, like, the government will say, oh, it was the can. Well, you ate canned food that you made yourself. It had to be what it is. They'll stop looking. And it's still an infinitesimally low number. Okay? If you choose to step outside of official guidance, own the thinking, the learning, and the risk. So if people say, I've talked about this before. With just electric canners, that people, we're going to talk about electric canners in a minute, people lose their fucking mind. Bro, chill the fuck out. The risk is my own. I know what I'm doing. I'm 53 years old, and I ain't dead yet, and I've never had illness from eating something that I canned or prepared for myself in my life. Nor did I ever get that from anything my parents made or my grandparents on either side made or any of my old country aunts, okay? And I'm talking old country. I'm talking people that were born in the 1800s. Did I eat the food that they preserved with these methods? And I've always been fine. But I also understand, like I said, these old ladies, they knew the risks. They knew the procedures. They had guidance. It just wasn't from the government, because the government was the last people these old ladies would trust. And then don't do something just because the government says not to. Don't start looking for rules to break for the purpose of breaking rules. That's not what this is. What this is about is, what is the problem you're trying to solve? And what is the best way to solve that problem? And if it happens to be canning outside of USDA recommendations, then the answer is the answer. Some things that I don't think people should do, even if they're safe, right? Don't do things for just the sake of novelty or, like, convenience to the extreme. Here's an example. I'm going to add some groups on Facebook to the show notes. I realized looking at my notes here on the other screen that I didn't do that like I had planned. But there's a couple that I'm a member of on Facebook, and one's a really good one. And there was just a lady on there, and she posted pictures, and she said, I tried to make, you know, canned macaroni and cheese. And all my macaroni exploded. It's just not edible at this point, right? And I thought of, and I thought about it, and then I looked at the comments. The comments were all right where my thinking was. Like, why are you doing this? Like, canning noodles in the first place is tricky. I mean, you got to get the time just right. And that includes, but not going too short for all the other things in the jar. You're trying to put two things together, a thick, dense sauce and a light, fluffy noodle. Why are you doing this? Does anybody out there know what, like, how long does macaroni store in on the shelf in the box that it came in with no special treatment? You're talking a couple years by the expiration date. And that's only there because the government makes them put it. You can keep noodles for 10 fucking years with almost doing nothing to them. If they were stored in a 5-gallon bucket with an O2 absorber, it's probably more like 25. Why are you taking the time and energy and money to take something you could prepare in 5 minutes to put it in a jar? It doesn't make any sense. Now, a cheese sauce that could be used for macaroni and cheese and other things, that would make sense, and that would be a good item to can and find the right, you know, parameters for doing that. And then you just take your dry macaroni and boil it and add your, and now you have your mac and cheese, if that's what you want. So I think there's just some things that they just don't work out well, and it's great. So there is someone here that made I'll get to it when I do questions and comments at the end, a tortellini that worked out. If it worked for you, that's fine, but I bet you it's not sitting in a big, giant, thick sauce either. And if it works for you, it works for you. And tortellini, I can see why you would do that because it's got stuff inside it, and it doesn't work as well as a dry noodle product. It doesn't store as long. Okay. But I probably still wouldn't. But if you want to, that's, I'm not saying not to do it at all. I'm saying, like, does it make sense to take elbow macaroni and go through all this shit because you want the convenience of mac and cheese in a jar? I don't think it really does. The flavor and texture of a thing is very degraded by canning. If that's true of a thing and there's any other way to preserve it, I would look there. There are certain things I just don't want to can. For instance, jalapeno peppers. If you want to make a pickled jalapeno, that's easy. And if you want it to be canned, you can water bath can it, and that's okay. But when I do a jalapeno pickle, I slice the pickles, I put them into a clean jar after they're washed, I add a pickling brine, I put a lid on it, and I stick it in the refrigerator for a couple days. That's it. I don't even heat it. Because the vinegar is enough, and I do like a 1-3 ratio, so one part vinegar to three parts water, and a pickle brine for that. I don't worry about that at all. It's going to the refrigerator. If I wanted to make it shelf stable, I would water bath can it for an appropriate time. If you want to not pickle a jalapeno pepper, and you follow, you know, common sense, and you pressure can it long enough to sit in water and be shelf stable, it has no flavor and no texture left. So I'm just not going to do that. So there's certain things that just, if you don't really care for it when it comes out of the can, then canning is your last ditch. I have to preserve this some way type of situation, right? And again, I think rice doesn't make sense either. I have seen people pressure can, like, the girl called it, unstuffed peppers, and it was peppers and some tomato sauce and ground beef and rice. So it was like a deconstructed stuffed pepper, and she made it work, and that's okay. But again, rice is one of those things that can just explode. And I look at that and I go, why not you just make the pepper mix, the tomato peppers and ground beef thing, which can be used a variety of ways. And if you want really quick results with your rice, get minute rice. That makes a lot more sense to me, and it's a lot more space efficient for your canning. and it removes a variable. If, again, these are the things that if you want to do them, you can. I just recommend there's better ways to do this, in my opinion. What are some reasons we should can in general? I think that's important to ask too, because rebel canning is just that we're canning with our own intent and our own understanding. And to me, there's really four big reasons to can. The first one is convenience. It's a thing. Having food that has no bullshit in it that you can just make. And that's why I said I like the idea of potentially doing something like the pepper, like the stuffed pepper thing that lady did without the rice. Because I can do other things with that. I can make a quick chili with that. So throw some chili powder, maybe cook some fresh onions and do it like a Holy Trinity cookdown and some chili peppers, you know, with that. And then throw a couple jars of that in there, maybe a little bit of beef stock added to it, chili powder, boom, quick chili, right? Or I can do with rice and I can make it a stuffed pepper thing. And I have more versatility that way. And so when you start looking about all the things you can, there's a lot of situations where I can actually pull from the same pantry, use the same protein, and go 2-3 nights in a row with the same protein, making different things with very little extra work. So convenience or stacking time. You're doing the work for multiple meals in the time it takes to make one meal, and then you're time banking it for later, and it's convenience. Number two is control. You know exactly what is and is not in your food, and that is both for taste and health. It also is nice and convenient because, like, you can do that, like, if you have a relationship where one spouse has to eat less salt or something, you can cut that back as long as it's not going to interfere with the canning efficiency, and that way the other party can add what they need. So you know what's in a thing. If you don't want GMOs, don't put GMOs in your canned food. There won't be in there. If you buy canned food from the store, it's probably in there. You're not having whatever weird lining they're using in the cans you buy at the grocery store. You know, you have complete and total control. The next is cost savings. Now, in general, I don't think you can go out and buy the cheapest green beans you can get fresh in the store, bring them home, chop them into size, put them into a jar, and can them and account for the energy and your time and save money over buying Del Monte off the shelf. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is, first of all, it's probably better quality if you were to do that. But the bigger savings is when you learn how to do this to the point where you can do things like canned meat. We've all walked into a grocery store and all of a sudden they're having some sort of big sale. It's in the summertime. They expect people to buy like one package of them and they're selling something like really nice, thick, beautiful USDA strip steak for $4 a pound. Do you know how much I buy when they do that? All of it. All of it. Well, I have like four freezers, so that's easy for me to deal with, but a lot of people would not. But it's steak, Jackie. It's less than ground beef at that price. So there's and many cuts that they'll put on sale like that that are way lesser than a strip steak, like a Chuck Mock tender or a bottom round or a top round. When we can them, they get really super tender. So when they put that shit on super cheap for sale and you know how to, you have this skill set, you can buy a whole ass load of it and can it. And now you have a shelf-stable product that you can use whenever you need a protein that you paid a lot less money for. That's cost savings. If you're a gardener, your cost saving is infinite because the only real inputs you have are maybe some seasoning and spices and salt or whatever, and your energy, which can be very, very low because you're not paying for the product outright. So those big harvests get preserved, and that saves money in that you don't lose them as well. And then skill development. So I've got convenience, control, cost savings, and skill development. This is a skill that empowers everything modern survivalism is all about. Because it's first of all, it's a hard skill. Second of all, it's a kitchen/cooking skill that saves money. And third of all, it's a food preservation skill. And if you can knock that out in your life, you have a tremendous arrow in your quiver toward adaptation in tough times. So I think that that's your reason for doing this, no matter how or what guidance you follow or don't follow. I do want to say a little bit on electric canners here. Yes, they're safe. Millions of people use them. Companies have huge liability here. Okay. USDA is still living 50 years in the past. So when you, Karen shows up to your Facebook group or your community event or whatever, I can't believe you're using an electric canner. USDA, fuck off, Karen. I'm sorry. I don't have any time for this nonsense. How something gets to 15 PSI in a pressure can environment, whether that is from an electric stove being conducted by the bottom of a pressure cooker that's metal and like an all-American or something, or because a computer running an electronic heater did it, if it reaches pressure, it reaches pressure. If it reaches pressure, it reaches temperature. And all of the shit that I heard when I started recommending electric canners, like, it doesn't vent the steam. Yes, it does. In fact, they all do, because it would be a problem even just from a pressure cooking standpoint. But the biggest thing is when a company puts the word pressure canner on the product, if that product was not sufficient to do the job, the class action lawsuit that you're talking about is in the billions of dollars. No such lawsuits have come. We have had millions upon millions of these things sold and used. You can go find a dozen groups with people using them right now to pressure can things that are low acid. And you can't find any of the horror stories that anybody's talking about anywhere ever actually occurring. It's just not a thing. So they're absolutely safe if you use them as directed. I do think you should only use pressure canners marketed as such, not a repurposed electric pressure cooker. And the reason is I have no way of knowing what standards that machine was built to if the company won't put their ass on the line and call it a canner. 99% chance it would be just fine. But you don't know that. There's no fail safes built into it if pressure's not reached. Because the only thing that happens is the super tough chunk of meat you threw in there isn't quite as tender as you wanted it to be, and it would have needed another 10 minutes. But you're not going to get sick or die from that, okay? Whereas if you actually fail to meet temperature and you believe that you did, and you don't follow the extra rules, then there is some risk. And I just don't believe in using a tool that's not meant for the job you're using it for if you have another option, and you do. In many ways, they're easier to use. And because they're easier to use, they actually reduce the risk of a problem instead of increase it. There's not much of a learning curve. In other words, when you use a pressure canner, a typical, like, put it on top of the stove pressure canner, is it venting? Did it vent the entire time you were gone? Or did it drop back down and did the petcock stop going and what have you? Right? So you kind of have to babysit it. You have to pay more attention to it, right? And I remember my grandmother doing that on, like, a coal stove. You talk about having to babysit something. So when I found electric canning, it was not only easier, it actually reduced the learning curve for me in relearning a skill that I had as a kid and hadn't used for, you know, 15 years. Glass stovetop owners really might want to get a pressure canner because an electric pressure canner, because you really shouldn't be doing pressure canning on a glass top stove. I won't get into why. I'm just saying that everybody says not to, including the people that make the stove. And including the people that make a pressure canner, mainly because it's a big, giant, heavy, super duper hot thing and it can cause fracturing of the glass. But there's some other concerns as well. And then the best thing about an electric canner is it's really easy to take it outside and plug it into an outdoor outlet on your back porch. Why would you want to do that? Because canning produces a lot of heat. You know, if you have a big, giant, all-American, double-stack pressure canner on your stove and it's July and it's sitting there and you're pressure canning at, you know, 15 PSI for 35 minutes, at first it has to get up to where it starts to actually pressurize. So that's a lot of heat emanating off of it. But then, and that steam's just going into your house. So now you've got hot, humid conditions in July in your kitchen, or August in your kitchen, or down here in Texas, September and October in your kitchen. Not good. Hot. Outside, don't give a shit. And then you really need to pay attention with those canners so that you don't overprocess, because they don't have a shutoff. You're the shutoff, right? Electric pressure canners, when they get to the end of their cycle, they reduce the heat and they begin to vent off because they don't have the pressure maintained. It's still a better practice to, when they reach that point and they're cooling down, to make sure they're not in like a keep warm setting or something like that, because a lot of them have that as well. But in the end, it will shut itself off when it's done. And it will throw an error code if anything goes wrong. So I think that there, every objection I've ever heard to an electric canner always goes back, but the USDA, and I don't care what the USDA says about something they've never tested, so they can piss off. Yeah. Next up, I want to talk about a few really good electric canners that you can consider for your needs. The first is the one I've recommended forever, and it's a good entry-level tool. Some of the other ones I'm going to show you today did not exist when I first started using this. And if I was buying one today, I wouldn't buy this unless I didn't have the money to buy the other ones I'm going to show you. The other ones are significantly more expensive. And due to that, if you don't have the money, this is still a good entry product. And in fact, it's today's item of the day. It's the Nesco, also known as the Carry Smart Pressure Canner and Cooker. This does all the things. It is a pressure canner. It is a pressure cooker. It is a basically like a crock pot. It will brown and sear, and it's a great, it's like an Instapot that also does pressure canning. And it's great for that. It does not do water bath canning. It doesn't have a setting for that. And there's some confusion with it. Well, is it Nesco? Is it Carry? Is it Nesco Carry? The two companies merged. And they've had kind of a branding thing that went on with, it was one, then it was the other, then it was both, then it was one again. They're all the same. They're all identical. All the parts are the same. The dimensions are the same. The specs are the same. They're all the same. These sell for about $160 to $175, depending on what day of the week it is and what the pricing algorithms do on Amazon. Very, very good tool. Not my number one recommendation anymore. Presto has started making really great pressure canners that are also water bath canners. So they have two settings, pressure and water bath, or you can use them for pressure cooking and other things as well. This is the smallest one they make. It's 12 quarts, so even that's a little bit bigger than the Nesco, but it's $324 for the 12 quart. They also make a 17 quart, which is $419. And additionally to that, they make their biggest one that's 23 quarts, and they make a 16. And those are both in a different model. It's all stainless steel, et cetera. This is very expensive if you think of it that way. At $459, the 23 quart all stainless steel Presto canner. This, if I did not own an electric canner already, and I was buying one today, I would spend the money and I would buy this due to capacity and flexibility. I might buy one of these anyway relatively soon because it is so much better than the Carry that I have. More, if I don't, I expect that sooner or later my Carry will crap the bed, and when it does, this is what I will buy. If you're thinking that's really expensive, there is nothing wrong with buying a good old-fashioned stovetop style pressure canner, right? Nothing wrong with doing that at all in any way, shape, or form. I'm just telling you that it's 2026. We live in the era of computer technology. Computers do everything. There go the girl dogs upset about something. Why don't you worry about security much? Because if you want to get bit by a Malinois, go ahead, right? Anyway, we do live in the world of computer technology. You trust, like, we're starting to trust computers to drive our cars. If a computer can drive a car with people and vehicles and everything moving around, a computer can hold a temperature and a pressure. It's a pretty low standard for automation. So I think if you have the funding and you want your life to be easy, electric canning is the way to go. My final thoughts. Remember, disobedience is the way of free thinkers, but thinkers only do things for good reasons. Okay? Let me say that again. Disobedience is the way of free thinkers, but free thinkers only do things for good reasons. And what I mean by that is I'm not going to disobey just to disobey. Why? What is the problem you're trying to solve? Or another way I've been phrasing this a lot lately, what does winning look like? What are you trying to do, and why are you trying to do it that particular way? What is the result that you're looking for? And if the result is I'm looking to have canned tomatoes that are cubed for what because I don't know what reason, then you can cube your fucking tomatoes no matter what the USDA says. And you can follow the same high acid water bath canning method and they will be fucking fine. And if anybody tells you that they won't be fine, ask them to explain the mechanism by which it will not be fine. And when they can't explain the mechanism, take their certainty and move it where it belongs, which is in the bottom of the toilet when you flush it. Okay, because they're speaking from a place of certainty with no understanding of what they're saying. They are a rule follower. And I kind of want to reiterate then about why these standards are the way they are, and why the government takes that approach, and why all of the food guidance agency bullshit people take this approach. Okay? because most people in the world are stupid and can't think. Because we have an awful lot of people walking around talking like they know things with IQs under 90. That's why. And we have people that are obsessive, compulsive rule followers, but only as many rules as they can remember. So if you give them, like, when they're making the can to good, they'll follow the rules. But 6 months later, when they open the can, good things like, you know, this really should probably go on the stovetop and be simmered for 10 minutes. They may not do that, and they'll take it to the church picnic and dump it in the slow cooker that never gets up above 150 degrees and wonder why everybody got sick. They have built the standard to that person. If you are that person, you should probably follow it. The standard should be followed by the people the standards were written for. And most government standards like this, okay, most of them were written for the lowest common denominator, people that cannot think independently. So when you choose to think independently, you have to go all the way through with it. And I do want to make sure that I explain botulism one more time due to this comment right here by Ron. He says, if you kill botulism, you kill botulism. I don't know if you were here earlier, Ron, but right now, if you swallow the saliva in your mouth, you just swallowed botulism. It's alive. You just swallowed inert botulism spores. It is one of the most common things on planet Earth. It is literally everywhere. That's why it's such a risk when you handle food improperly. You can't see it. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. You can't know that it's there. And if you give it a place that it can incubate, then as it reproduces, it produces a toxin. When we boil food for at least 10 minutes, and that's more than necessary, but that's like, again, we're going to make sure that we really did it. We don't kill the botulism. And Karen, who comes to your Facebook group, will tell you that, and she'll be right about that, but it's irrelevant to the situation. What we do is we make and denature the toxin. We render it inert, and it can't just come back. The food would then have to be in a proper environment for the spores, which will still be alive at that point, to begin to reproduce again. And high oxygen is not that environment. See how that works? So it's not about killing botulism unless we're killing botulism during the canning process so that it doesn't reproduce inside the jar. And that may be what he was commenting about, because there's a lag in different people at different levels in the show. So he might have been talking about in relation to electric canners. I just want to make sure that I'm clear about that. Just, again, always remember, this guidance is not bad. It's just incomplete. So it always should be your anchor you look back to. And if you do that, you'll be just fine. And if you get involved with these active rebel canning groups, you'll be able to do things you never thought of that you won't find in these published books or whatever, because everybody's afraid of getting sued. But if you come at it, again, from a group intelligence viewpoint versus a group think viewpoint, and I did this show today because how many things does that apply to? How many things in this world, you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you shouldn't do this, and you shouldn't do that. But when you get a bunch of people together that are independent thinkers, and they kind of like take and report their own results, and instead of letting any one clown be in charge, you allow the collective of the group to work together with independent thought on a common idea. You refine that idea into something that actually is manageable and works, and now we can go forward with that. Don't listen to people that speak theoretically about things that are material. If it's a material thing, the person that you want to listen to is a person that actually works with it in the material world, not in theory. And again, I'm going to go back to do all the things I said today, and you're still 40,000 times more likely to die in a car wreck than get sick seriously from canned food. And I'll leave it at that. With that, let's go ahead and see the few people. I only got a couple comments here. I have one from Rachel, and I have one from Heartland Family, and I probably missed some. If you're still with me, and you're not one of those people, and you have a comment or a question for me, do it right now. Put it in the live chat feed, and when I'm done answering these two, I'll come back around and check before we wrap up. So Rachel says, Nicole Sauce has good canning webinars. Absolutely, she does. Absolutely, she does. If you want to learn more about food preservation, Nicole is a goat. She really is. She's a great person to listen to. Heartland Family Designs says, I just made canned tortellini, and it's great. Just heat and eat. Sometimes we don't have water to boil noodles. And like I said, okay, and that's the thing. Like, these groups will help you dial certain things in. They will help you dial certain things in. That's just not something that I would probably do. That's just not kind of the route that I take. To be fair, I also don't eat a lot of noodles or rice or even potatoes. So that's not really something that I've tweaked with a bunch. But I would say that there are certain things that do not lend themselves to ease of canning. And even if they can be done, maybe they're not the place to start. And what I'll wrap up with, and just to give people some more time that are on the lag to get me your question or comment if I didn't get to it and I missed it and you're still here. When I teach people to garden, and the first question is, and there's like, I want to do a garden this year, blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, wait a minute. Have you ever grown a garden before? And I pulled weeds from my grandpa is a no. Right. Have you ever actually done a full season of gardening before? No. Okay. The first thing I'm going to tell you in your first year is if it's a plant that you really need to start in a pot and then set out as a plant due to time constraints, like a tomato or something. It's not like a squash or a bean where you just put the seed in the ground and you need started plants. That first season, it's probably the best to buy your plants. Why? Learning to start plants from seed and get them into healthy, young, set out sized plants at the right time is a skill set. There's a dozen other skill sets in running a garden. Let's eliminate that one the first year. Dial in the other one, and then next year, build your seed starting system. Start starting your own plants. Yeah? Makes sense? Okay. When there's things like that get complicated with things that explode if you do it the wrong. When I say explode, I don't mean blow up for the small brains out there, smooth brains, right? I mean they're just not good to eat as food anymore. And you know, macaroni noodles will do it, man. You know, if you've ever accidentally, like if you had a noodle soup on the stove and you turned it on, you forgot about it, and you overboiled it, you know it doesn't have to be canned for that to happen. You can basically blow up a noodle or overcook rice, like it's a thing. Maybe it makes sense start out with the easy stuff and then slowly transition over to the more complex things. But definitely get involved with these canning groups. Again, I'm going to make sure I add several different rebel canning groups to the show notes for you guys. There'll be any audio notes. If you're watching the video live or in the future, right down in the video description, there's a whole bunch of stuff down there, and one of them is a link. The first link will take you over to the audio side. If you're watching this live or within maybe 30 minutes of it ending, it's probably not there yet because I'm not done. I have to go actually produce the audio-only version, upload it, and publish it. So I'll get on that right now. With that, tomorrow we have an interview, then we have an expert counsel show on Thursday, and that wraps up the week. We're back to regularly scheduled programming until, like the next week. We're going to go take a little short vacation, so I think you're going to have, not next week, maybe the week after. I'm not sure. I got to check my calendar now, but it's closer than I think it is. I know that. You'll probably get one rewind. I think I'm going to have no problem doing a show for you Monday and Tuesday that week. As long as the stars align, I'll get an expert. You know, if there's enough content from the Piker tree, like, I'll get you guys an expert counsel that week, and we'll just have the Wednesday with a rewind. And I think maybe Monday of the following week will be a rewind, because I think that's, we're flying back on a Monday, if I remember right. I have to talk to my wife who just got home. That's why the girl dogs went ape shit. Anyway, with that, I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Take care. Remember, always, like, share my show with other people. That's how we built it into what it is. That's how we've made it what it's been for 18 years. Thank you to all of you who have helped with that. You
they said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.